You're listening to the 21st Century Change Agent Show, the podcast created to inspire you to make a meaningful change in your family, organization, or community, so we can all enjoy the benefits of living in the 21st century. My name is Bybee Ziga, and I'm a proud millennial, entrepreneur, and a consultant at Lakehouse Consulting, where we inspire individuals and organizations to think differently. On this show, I'm sitting down with real change makers to talk about their journey on making an impact and driving one community at a time into the 21st century. Thank you for listening. Welcome to this episode, everyone, and to the month of December. Hang in there, we are almost done with this year, and I'm here to help you finishing this year strong and energized. I'm sure we all love to travel, as it allows us to meet new people and immerse ourselves in local culture. Unfortunately, I can't get you on a plane right now, but what I can do is bring some of this international flavour to your home. So this month, I will be taking you to Lagos, Nigeria, Toronto, Canada, New York, and we'll be landing back here in London. Make sure you subscribe so you don't miss out on this trip. And so our first stop today is Lagos, Nigeria, where I catch up with Amanda Obidike. Amanda is probably one of the most inspirational, forward-thinking and driven individuals I've met. Her mission is to, I quote, make Africa by us, for us. I had a very bold and open conversation with Amanda about being a businesswoman in Africa, the role of government and the society, white heroes, and there being no black people in Africa. Thank you for joining us today. And don't forget to tweet using hashtag Change Agent Podcast. Other than that, buckle in and enjoy the trip. Amanda, welcome to the show. I'm so pleased that you could carve some time out to join me here in this conversation. And I'm already looking forward to it because I know it's going to be a very bold and rich conversation. I've heard you speak. I have seen your content. I've seen your work. And it's some really incredible change that you're making in society. So I'm super, super excited to hear your thoughts on various very topical and big subjects. Thank you for joining me and welcome.
Wow, thank you so much, Biba. I'm really happy and excited to be on this platform and share about my story to your audience. So thank you so much.
Thank you, Amanda. And so that's exactly what I wanted to start with, is your story. So you are a data scientist, you're an entrepreneur, you are a human rights activist and advocate. So in your own words, we would all love to hear your story. Where did this all begin? And on which junction of that journey are you today? What is your mission? What are your ultimate goals? Would love to hear that.
Okay. Thank you so much, Beba. So first things first, I'm from Lagos, Nigeria in West Africa. And yes, I'm a data scientist, a STEM educationist. I'm an entrepreneur. I'm also a teacher. I do a lot of things, actually. And the reason is because I see gaps and I feel that I can fill this gap with the little knowledge I have, just to ensure that people are happy, people are self-reliant, and people live fulfilled lives. So my journey began in 3 years ago when I graduated from the university. You know, I schooled in Obafemi Awolowo University, and I had very good grades and all, but unfortunately, graduating from the university, I didn't get the good job I desired. You know, we all have this dream job on, okay, we are transitioning from education to employment, but that didn't happen. And it's because of this leaky unemployment pipeline we have. People get to go to the university. We have this certificate, but we are not really certified. We do not have the skills that the job market needs. You know, so I was unemployed and I was so depressed, you know, because nothing was happening with my life. I got a friend who, you know, told me about this IBM training that they would like to take people on data science and business intelligence. And I was reluctant because then I didn't have good knowledge and good use in mathematics or computer technology. So, but, you know, when I went to the IBM, I saw the atmosphere. I saw how things were, you know, were being driven in a modern way. And I felt, wow, I need to put my best. And, you know, after the training, I excelled good enough. It was even surprising for people because I was the only one with no technology background. But, you know, I was amongst the first 5%. And after that, you know, usually after you do that, you're meant to get a job because now you are certified in data analytics. And I thought to myself that rather than get a job, why don't I also train people? You know, why don't I give these skills for free the same way IBM did the same? And that was what made me to bet STEMI Makers Africa. It's a non-profit organization. So what we do is we train people. We train people from even teachers in school because we know that our school is so fragmented. You know, we have inherited this leaky education system where teachers do not have basic resources to ensure that science is exciting for students or mathematics and all. So we train teachers on one part. We also mentor young women and girls because we know that we have very little and few of them in the continent. Then we also like give skill-based trainings to youths or teenagers, you know, through like after-school programs, campus ambassador programs, etc. So the journey has been beautiful because we are just 2 years, but the impact has been tremendous. You know, we have been able to spread across Africa. We're already in 19 countries. And, you know, people ask, oh, wow, that's so fast. But I realized that it was easy for us to scale because there was a need. There is a need in the continent. People reach out to us on a daily saying they would like to, you know, bring this into their country or into their community. They want people to know better. They want people to do better. So the journey actually began thanks to a program that I did with the Barack Obama Yali Foundation. So it's a way of you get to network with people around Africa. And, you know, after the program, I still kept in touch with these people. So when I was even trying to, like, build STEMI, a lot of them were also interested in how they can, you know, integrate this or bring STEMI to their local community. Then where are we going? Well, I have this thoughts in my head. I call it an Africa by us for us. So you realize sadly that most times people finish from the university, but because of their discontented on what our society is offering us, the government is actually offering less, unfortunately. So most times people try to migrate. They either go to countries like Canada, USA, London, and all. So we try to ensure that in as much as we're training these people, we should also be able to connect with them to employers in the market, you know, where they can not take their skills or their knowledge to other continents, but they should rather be here to enrich the continent. So it's like an Africa by us for us, where we train ourselves. We also, you know, integrate ourselves into the system just to ensure that things get better.
That sounds absolutely amazing. And the fact that you've spread yourself and this STEMI Makers Africa idea and entity across 19 countries already, I think deserves a standing ovation. I think it's absolutely fantastic. And that's only the beginning of the journey. So, you know, if this is what you have done in 3 years, I think the world is your oyster in terms of what you can do in the next 3, 5, or 10 years with upskilling these students, upskilling the teachers, the education system, having the leverage to influence policymakers and government systems. It could go absolutely viral, which is absolutely amazing that, you know, the whole mission is about keeping the talent in-house rather than training these people up and letting them and allowing them to float away to the Western world just because the internal country and systems do not have you know, the right policy and the right support in place to keep this talent in house. I would like to sort of go into the STEM subject a little bit deeper. So obviously you mentioned you're in 19 sub-Saharan countries already. So what does the STEM space at the moment look like in these countries, and what are the differences between some of these places that you see?
There are gaps. there are places where communities where you go to, people do not even have access to internet or to devices that can browse. But on the other hand, we look at these limitations and say, no, it's even a more reason why we should propel further. And in these communities, there are times where some communities or countries are totally underserved. Communities and countries like Uganda, for example, Mali, at least Nigeria, we have an advantage because even if maybe the system is not so favorable, but at least you get to say that underserved communities get to access internet or get to access devices. You know, problems differ per countries, I must say. But one thing is sure, that technology is still untapped in all of these countries, because I believe that, for example, if technology is being like explored, a standard teacher should be able to integrate innovation or technology into his or her classroom. You know, same thing for an employer. So most times it differs. I'll give you, for instance, Cameroon. Cameroon is like our neighboring country in Nigeria. Now, Cameroon, they are so excited about anything that comes to STEM. But things are so difficult that as little as visiting schools, as an NGO, you need to go to the government. You need to get like some kind of paperwork. And also, these kind of things can be so demotivating for us or for our volunteers there, because you are talking about, you are bringing in change for free to, you know, the schools, and the government is just making it so difficult for you to help these schools or to help teachers. So it differs. To tell you the truth, sometimes all these challenges can be very frustrating. There are times you can just ask yourself, why don't I just close down? I just like leave. But, you know, you hear their stories. Success stories are like what, you know, propels us to still keep doing more and giving more.
Absolutely. I mean, behind all these stats and reports are real people at the end of the day with real emotions and stories. And the fact that you might have contributed to them making a better life is very humbling and empowering, I'm sure. Speaking of barriers, and you already mentioned a few in terms of institution and government bodies that do not make it easy for you and your foundation to bring this important and meaningful change to their communities. However, there is another layer to those barriers, I'm sure, which is the fact that you're a female. What is it like to be a woman, and even more so a businesswoman in Nigeria, and maybe some stories from wider Africa? What are some of the societal expectations and boundaries that often take women out of education, that way very literally robbing the society and the business world?
We call Nigeria the giant of Africa. We are the giant of Africa with so many reasons. Number one is due to our population. We are the most populated country, black country in the world. And we have over 370 races or, you know, tribes in Nigeria. So we are so dynamic. Number one, we are heterogeneous, and we are densely populated. But you know, a lot of expectations come from Nigeria, where because you see our performance, you know, in the Western world, you see how young talents are really you know, they are really intelligent, they are doing exceptionally well, and you are wondering what is wrong in the country where they come from. Now, we have stereotypes, you know, existing, whether from the 17th century down to today. And, you know, education has come to stay in Nigeria. We are still learning, we are still researching, but there are still limitations. Now, for instance, an average young girl of 18 years old, the society is expecting that by the time she graduates, by at the age of 24 or 22, she should be able to have gotten married or have kids or, you know, set up a family. And, you know, it has not been the order of the day, because now a lot of times young women like me feel that there is more to life, you know, than just giving birth to babies and, you know, just setting up homes. And because of this awakening, there has been a lot of conversations around it. You know, for instance, in the North, where we have done several projects, you know, trying to address this gender exclusion or social exclusion, where young girls as little as 12 are not entitled to going to secondary schools. That's a problem. We're not even talking about tertiary institutions. And we are meeting religious leaders, for example, our local government, telling them that these girls should be given a chance at least to learn a skill, even if you do not want her to go to school, or even if the husband do not want her to go to school. Mind you that these girls are just teenagers. And you find out that that's a problem. What we had to do was we started to give this new orientation. Orientation in community spaces, orientation in religious spaces, because Nigeria, we are too religious. Life is more than that. So it's not just about addressing this underrepresentation. There has also been a stock in people's mentality where young girls should not be able to have certain things out of life. Take me, for instance. I've been in several conferences and several spaces where men ask me, am I married? And I say no. And the next question that comes out from them is, why am I not married? And at first, I found it to be funny. But later on, I started drafting or designing in responses to them. I made them understand that life goes beyond just marriage, or life goes beyond just having family. So it's about, giving this orientation, societal orientation. That is what we need, because it has not just affected women in dreaming. It has also increased gender-based violence. So you see young girls, maybe in their family, they want to, you know, go for further studies, and it's either they're being harassed by their relatives or by their fathers or by, you know, men besides them, telling them that they cannot do this. And, you know, it goes into abuse. So a lot of times this exists, not just in Nigeria, but in other countries. We have a lot of these similar scenarios happening all over Africa, you know. And but I'm happy for one thing, because, you know, my generation has, you know, been able, and they have been wonderful in designing great initiatives to ensure that orientation is taking place, not just for the communities, but for the boys and the men also. We feel that they need to know, because they should be able to have a better orientation in telling their sisters, in telling their mothers. So it's a joint effort that, you know, we are doing to ensure that we set things right. We see what's happening in the Western world, and I will tell you the truth, we admire that, because we see men encourage women to do a lot of things, whether in the workspace or in the community space. We want to imbibe that.
The challenges are still there. Regardless of where you are, obviously you're talking about Africa and reflecting on Western world, but we've got very similar challenges here as well. However, what I love about your story is that this mission of Semimakers Africa, where you are sharing this knowledge and educating both sides, males and females, students and teachers, and leave no one behind, and are mentoring them to have more empathy towards each other and learn from each other, so both sides can get most out of this partnership. And this is a fight that takes a village and beyond. It's a real movement. And not even talking about the system and the policy, it is the partners, it is the parents, it is the families. And of course we talk about the power of family and community, but in terms of political power, would I be right saying that in countries in Africa, governments deliberately drive illiteracy and ignorance for political benefit?
Of course, Beba. We've seen it happen. Even, for example, this year, the government eats on our ignorance, if I should use that word. You know, there are basic rights that youth or, you know, grown-ups should have about the government, about holding them accountable, we do not have, and they leverage on that silence. I'll give you a clear example of what happened globally. Now, killings, unfortunately, have been happening over years in a densely illiterate community. Take, for instance, the North. And, you know, because they have little knowledge on the internet or making their voices heard, things happen there for years. You know, and nobody has been saying anything. about it. But now come down to the West where, you know, we have young minds, they know how to leverage on the internet, they have been able to build a community online. You know, they started tweeting about the NSAS protest, sharing live videos of what was happening, making the world aware. Now, when that happened, when it was released, the government absolutely denied that certain things exist. And, you know, evidences were springing up showing that this indeed happened. Al Jazeera, BBC, CNN aired it for days. And as a matter of fact, they said NSAS, the hashtag NSAS, had never trended like any other hashtags ever in the world. For 1 week, we had more than 20 million tweets about that. Now, why I'm saying this is we understood our voice. We understood that our voice can go far if we try to amplify it. And the government on their own part were shocked that we could find our voices, we could use a platform, and everybody was seeing what was happening. Why I'm saying this is over time, the government has taken advantage of our silence. And this silence is built by we do not know our rights. We do not know how to communicate our rights. We do not know how to communicate our concerns. And after the NSAS address, the next thing we heard on the parliament is that they're going to introduce a bill called Social Media Bill, where they are going to gag people. Now, they, of course, you would know why they are trying to introduce certain bills, because they know that we had to use social media because we are inclined, we are literate to know the functions of social media. Even outside of that, of happening in Nigeria, you know, after it happened in Nigeria, some weeks after that, our Ethiopian team, the SEMA Ethiopian team, also reported that the police, the soldiers also had to wake up, you know, in harassing people about using their social media. I tell people a lot of times, we have a lot of resources. We have the resources. We just need to have the right people with the right mindset in managing these resources. So yes, again, Beiba, the government or the people, like the higher bodies, usually capitalize on our illiteracy, which is rather unfortunate.
And we see that everywhere, not only in Africa, but also in the Western world. I don't want to get too political, but take, for instance, the US elections that only concluded last month, or take previous elections when Donald Trump won. During this time, societal illiteracy and ignorance is exploited the most by inappropriate use of media and targeting, fake news and so on. I actually listened to a podcast recently. It's called the Alex Wolf podcast. So she's a young writer living in New York. And in one of her podcasts, she was talking about how people nowadays intake information. And it is mainly through image rather than a written word, let alone if these articles are actually intelligent articles that might have some real substance behind them, real context, some big words in them. Therefore, the language gets really dumbed down for us. So take the same old Donald Trump as a great example in terms of the language that he uses. So he often says, that's very, very good, or that's very, very bad. We were told back in third grade not to use such vocabulary in our essays. And here we have a president of one of the biggest and most powerful countries in the world talking like this, because he knows exactly who he is targeting and who his target audience is. But like I said, I don't want to get too political, but this is just sort of, you know, proving the point that, you know, it is not only Africa, it is happening in the Western world. And I do appreciate that, you know, the world often is looking up to these countries, but we often have to ask ourselves whether it's worth it. It is undeniable that the Westerners have a very distorted view of Africa. They see it as a place that needs a white hero to save it from poverty, famine, unemployment, illiteracy, and so on. However, from the material I read and follow and my own interactions with people from the continent, there is a huge amount of underrated intellect and entrepreneurial spirit there. And so much ambition, so much raw ambition. How institutionalized and dependent are you on the white system? How do you see, and do you see an opportunity for Africa breaking away from this white system? And what can be done so the money does not flow to the right businesses?
Okay, yeah, Biba. So, you know, we want to have a mind on our own, you know. For example, there are times where we have these unrelatable or not true stories that, you know, are being portrayed about Africa, you know. Just for example, I was telling somebody that, you know, we watched some films of Hollywood and they show, okay, they were in the U.S., they now had to come down to Africa, and you get to see some mud houses, you know, some. And I told them, I said, no, this is not like the true color or the true perspective of Africa. We have wonderful places, you know. We have a place that even looks like Las Vegas in the of the USA here. So why I'm saying this is, you know, all this narrative has really affected us psychologically, you know, economically, and etc. And that's why we want to build this an Africa by us system, where we do not need to wait for Western worlds or Western decisions to shape ours. Why don't we design decisions by ourselves and take these decisions on our own, you know, not blaming anybody, but doing it all by ourselves, you know. So it's still this same institutionalized narrative that we are trying to address, because it has affected us. It has affected how the world views us and how we even view ourselves. For instance, last month, an organization founded by two boys just in the university, they call them Paystack, they sold to Stripe. And the exit, they said it was the highest ever. It was going to 79 billion naira, which is, is more than $230 million, you know. And these boys, you know, they schooled in Nigeria, they stayed in Nigeria, they built it in Nigeria. It was a financial system that they built for the continent, and they sold to Stripe. Now that's amazing, you know. So people were really happy. But on the other hand, we that are entrepreneurs looked at it on the other angle and said, this is a good one for the continent, but we are still not happy that we had to exit this or sell it to the USA. We should have been able to use it for us, continue using it for ourselves. So that is where you now ask yourself, are you doing this for the money or are you doing it for impact? You know, so they may have done it for the money, you know, because, but hey, that's why it's their idea, and also we are not against it. But I said, if we want to build a sustainable continent, it's time for us to develop these things, no matter who wants to come and sell off or no matter who wants to buy off. We are not selling. We should still use it for the continent, you know, because now their name is going to be changing. It's going to be Stripe, you know, and all. Trust me, we have very brilliant people in Nigeria, you know. You go to some Ivy League schools, the first five class or the 10 like best graduates, one is a Nigerian. And you're asking yourself, this person, some person is very intelligent. Why didn't this person stay in his or her country? The person went there because the university in the USA has a good standard, and you don't blame them. But after graduating, they don't come back to the continent. They stay there because the system is favorable for them.
Yeah, I guess I can relate to that quite a lot, because ultimately that was exactly the reason why I left my homeland almost 10 years ago to come to the UK. Because I felt they couldn't meet my ambitions. They couldn't provide me the world level education that I was looking for. So I came, and the thing is that after 10 years, it is very hard going back to a place that you still potentially call your home, because the culture is different and the business world is different, the communication is different. And it would take time again to reintegrate back into it, even though you feel that you've got so much to give. And obviously there's a lot of movement or talk rather from the government around what they could do to bring this talent back and support this talent that has been educated abroad to bring it back home. I've heard a lot of talk. I haven't seen them walking their talk ultimately, in terms of, you know, what they would offer people who are expats. But then again, I ask myself, you know, how am I better than anyone who's currently in the country that government already can't look after? So where is the guarantee for me that, you know, with this all beautiful talk and promised land, that I'll be able to actually get it? And this is the vicious circle that we're all in. So I can absolutely relate to the frustrations that you have around people who potentially leave their homelands, do great things, get educated, but not necessarily come back anymore. But as we are on the topic of the distorted view the Westerners have of Africa, there is something else that I'd like to talk to you about. So I recently read an article that I also shared with you, which is titled, "There Are No Black People in Africa." So there are a couple of things in this article that I would like to talk about, and I'll share this article with our listeners in the notes section, so please have a read. But first and foremost, I want to hear your thoughts of this misconception of race. So the article author writes, and I quote this, "They don't become black until they go to America or come to Europe. They become black when they first land into the Western world that chooses to see them that way." So what are your thoughts on this quote and this misconception of race in general?
First things first, you know, the diversity of Africa's people is result from our diverse geography and our long prehistory. Now, in the late 90s, we used to understand that we can boldly, you know, go to, for example, I could go to Tanzania, and I don't necessarily need to say I'm Nigerian. I would say I'm Igbo. So we categorize ourselves by our tribes, because, for instance, in Nigeria, we have more than 300 going to 350, 360 tribes. But, you know, as civilization and globalization, you know, started coming in place, we started using certain kind of buzzwords. Although some people still feel comfortable using that, a lot of people do not. There are people that still go boldly and say, "I'm proudly Igbo, I'm proudly Yoruba, or I'm proudly Zulu." You know, but when globalization started creeping in into the continent, we now started, we preferred to say, "Oh, I'm African," or maybe "I'm Black African," because somebody would see you, maybe you are fair complexion, they will ask you if you are mixed race and all. So why I'm saying this is, time has made us to misunderstand our values as Africans. You know, there are times where you could even call yourself, "I'm proudly African," but sometimes you don't even get to hear narratives like that because of fear of maybe what somebody else would say, maybe if you went to the USA and all. So we've been seeing a lot of misrepresentation of our values, you know, creeping in. And, you know, when you shared that article with me, I was even looking at the context or the part where we even are categorizing Africa as sub-Saharan Africa and all. The reason is, you know, sadly, you find out that there has been a lot of exclusion, but it's a gradual exclusion. But now we are waking up to this consciousness of saying, "Hey, if we want to move, we need to move together. We don't want to align or misalign ourselves as, say, Eastern Africa, Northern Africa, or Western Africa. That doesn't make sense." And when we started having this realization, things started getting better, even for trade association. Because look at it in the context that before, I can't easily go to a country like Morocco or Libya. I need to have, I need to go get a visa. But as Africans, you know, there should be a level of easy entry and exits. So this separation and this division, you know, rather started pushing us away. But I'm happy for what initiatives like AU is already putting in place, you know, putting in clusters to ensure that if we want to move forward, if we want to design things, we need to collaborate, and we need to start removing that, you know, wrong mindset of, you are sub-Saharan African, you are not African, so you are not African, you know. So I really loved that article you shared, and I also believe that people should need to read about that. We need to understand and love ourselves, because if we do not love ourselves, wherever continent or whatever country we go to, we will still be stereotyped, we will still be divided, or we'll still have given that wrong narrative about ourselves, which is not meant to be.
And you're totally right about this term of sub-Saharan Africa, because this term divides more than unites, really.
Mm-hmm.
And in Western media, the region below Sahara, which consists of about 50 nations, represent regions of extreme poverty, vast masses of land infested with famine, which have no scope for human development, and every child would die if it wasn't for the generosity of the white donor. However, you have already mentioned in this conversation that there is nothing further from the truth, and you've got a lot of bright and very entrepreneurial minds. So the author of this suggests looking at two countries in this sub-Saharan region, as Western media has declared, Somalia and the Ivory Coast. So these two nations are as far away from each other as London is from Tehran. And on per capita basis, Ivory Coast GDP is seven times that of Somalia, roughly similar as the UK and Iran. Now, if someone was to say that Iran and UK are similar countries, they'd probably be laughed out of the room. But when it comes to African continent, esteemed institutions such as World Bank and United Nations still use terms sub-Sahara on daily basis, putting all of these 50 nations that are racially different, that they have got different cultures, religions, and they just put them into the same bucket and serve that to the Western world. And this is also one of the reasons why money that should stay within the continent is still exchanged in the wrong hands. I read a book a few years ago called The Prisoners of Geography by Tim Marshall. And one of the simplest yet most profound things that he wrote there, what that stuck to me to this day, was that Africa is the richest continent in the world, and yet the poorest.
True.
Any thoughts on that?
True, Beba. You know, this also brings me to a conversation I had a couple of weeks ago with Paystack. I was talking up to these founders and I was saying that I felt that we should be able to own such invention or own such initiative. So that is when you ask yourself, why are you doing this? Are you doing it for impact or are you doing it for profit? It would have been beautiful if we were able to still maintain Paystack and start competing on a global level. Because now Stripe from the USA has, you know, bought it and now it belongs to them. So I was telling them that enough of, because what if, for example, Western world or the UN or World Bank cease to stop giving African countries loans or funding, which every year they give us billions of dollars. And up till today, I don't know, it's never accounted for. You still find out that we are still going down in poverty. I tell them that what if these esteemed organizations quit giving us this money or quit helping us? How are we going to upskill or how are we going to improve our continent? It's initiatives like this that can sustain the continent, you know, to improve our economy, to increase jobs, to ensure that our work is being amplified. We can compete on a global level and, you know, we can be self-reliant as a continent. I think that's one of the important things that fellow Africans like me should start looking towards.
Of course, true. You know, this is not to say that the help is not welcome or the support and recognition is not welcome. It's to say it has to come with the right intentions and for the good of people.
Yes, it has to come. When it comes, we welcome it. Honestly, we really applaud what esteemed organizations or the UK, the US is doing for Nigeria till today, you know, but it's also good if we are able to create, you know, we shouldn't, let me just use this context of the proverb where they say, do not give me fish, but teach me how to fish. So we should also not only just be hoping strictly on getting fish from other countries or organizations, but we should be able to create and produce fish for ourselves. So not that they're not welcome. Of course they are welcome. You know, we need them, you know, to move forward, but we should also be able to help ourselves.
That is a very timeless proverb that really fits the context. I would also like to get your views on the Black Lives Matter movement and the overall problems, abuse and discrimination Black people face in the Western world. I know in September you joined the Wonder Women Tech Global panel on the London stage to talk about this. Again, not looking for this to get political. However, how is this movement viewed in Africa or closer to home in Nigeria? The reason why I'm curious is that thinking about how distorted view is the Western world has of Africa, wondering how distorted are the views and messages floating the opposite direction?
Okay, so Black Lives Matter, it was a global, everybody knew about Black Lives Matter, you know, during COVID and all, and it started opening our eyes to, you know, certain racism and, history of privilege that is existing in America, you know. So, and, these are also live experiences. And thankful for social media, a lot of people that have experienced it directly or indirectly came out to narrate their ordeal. So Black Lives Matter, for instance, is real. But if you even bring it down to Africa, we were not only talking about Black Lives Matter, we were talking about our own lives as well, because it was relatable. Talk about police brutality. We still face police brutality in Nigeria. So if, for example, which you can even ask, 3 in 5 youths have experienced intimidation from our police force. So if, for example, you have an iPhone or you have a tattoo, the police is going to stop you, ask you questions, harass you, possibly even, you know, tell you to pay some amount of money. Now, when it doesn't happen, you ask yourself, what's going to happen? Because there are times that they have threatened people. There are times they may have even injured people in the process. So Black Lives Matter is not just only applicable in America. It's applicable all over the world. So if you're talking about police brutality, you're talking about gender exclusion, you're talking about harassment, gender-based violence, we have been experiencing it. But I'm happy for one thing, that it happened at the right time, you know, this 2020, because it was a time for organizations, for example, to start aligning their values. It was a time for initiatives or young people to say, hey, it's time we promote diversity or inclusion into what we do. So it's not just about saying, okay, we are initiatives can accommodate Black people, but are you giving them a stake on the table? Are you bringing them on board leadership? Are you bringing them in, in decision making and the rest? So I'm happy that that happened, but you know, we are also concerned about, it shouldn't just go stop at being a protest, but there should be certain call to actions to ensure that lives are really valued. Black lives are really valued in America, in Africa, in Asia, you know, because unfortunately, you can, in any country that does not actually appreciate lives, you know, that country cannot progress. And we do not want to, you know, be talking about certain kind of things like this, you know, in this time. We should be looking about how to forge ahead. And the only way to forge ahead is about inclusion, bringing everyone on board, hearing what they have to say, whether it's people living with disabilities, whether it's people from different races, or whether it's from gender whatsoever. We all need to be on the table.
Right, because it is not about diversity in isolation, you know, about companies going out and making numbers by recruiting one person of color, one female, one disabled person. Listen, I worked in recruitment and talent teams. I know how the story goes. That does not make you diverse nor inclusive. Inclusivity is belonging to a community. These people are part of our families, friend groups, communities. They need to be given the seat at the table, allowed to speak up, bring their whole selves to work. All of these things are ones that have been talked about a lot, but still do not happen at a scale that it should.
Yeah.
However, I've got a great hope that this year has been the beginning of these narratives finally being addressed.
Yes, absolutely, Beba, absolutely. You know, everyone is saying 2021, we can't wait for 2021, but I'm like telling them that, number one, it's not like COVID is going to go automatically in 2021, or it's not like police is going to be better, or, you know, treat us better in 2021. It's not like a magic wand, but, you know, let's still keep on having this conversation. Let's still keep on driving this narrative, a right narrative that we want, you know, perceived, or we want to integrate into our community. So it's not just about protesting and, you know, going back to your bed, because trust me, that's what the society is. If actions are not being taken, 2 months down the line or 6 months down the line, another kind of poor encounter will happen. So we do not hope for that, you know, but just that whatever platform we have, let's just use our voices, let's use our resources, you know, just to ensure that, you know, it's well addressed and we have the society that we crave for.
That's right. I do have one last question. I know that Nigeria last month celebrated 60 years of being an independent country, and you very kindly invited me to a webinar with a lot of forward-thinking business people, scholars, academics, all reflecting on the past 60 years and also looking ahead to what's next. So what have been some of the key milestones during this time that you see as crucial foundations for the future? And what does Nigeria 2030 look like?
Okay, yeah. So first things first, thank you so much, Beba, for even joining us. You know, I really love that you were there. And, you know, from the conversation, it was more like an awakening conversation, because we asked ourselves, oh, Nigeria is 60 plus, but what are we? Do we look like a 60-year-old country, you know, that has gotten that independence, you know, since 1960? And, you know, it's time we reflected on it deeply, and we found out that sadly there is nothing much that we have been able to achieve as a nation. So we are either still going deep into borrowing, you know, having debt, you know, development or innovation is being low and all. But as for milestones, for one thing, I know I'll use this one word called accountability. You know, now the youths are becoming very wise, in the sense that they know that there are a lot of expectations now. So gone are the days where we believe that, okay, maybe things are just being bad because of the whole, the world is not really favorable. But now we know that we have the resources, we can move and drive these resources to have better livelihood, to be self-reliant, or to even be problem solvers using technology. You know, because it's not too long after the independence that we had this national protest all over the 36 states in Nigeria. So the protest was all about not just police, ending police brutality, but for the youths holding the government accountable, saying we need for our education institutions to work. We need our health workers to be well paid. We need our securities to be well paid. We need for children to be safe. You know, so all this has been the narration since the independence. But the good thing about it is that, which I'm seeing it happen, you know, we used to believe that, okay, we should delve into politics because we are grown up to be until you are 50 and all. Youth now are waking up to this, because now they have seen that nothing much was really done for 60 years. And everybody is saying it's time that for me to demand responsibility or accountability, I need to be responsible. So I'm seeing youth now take up responsibility, like, for example, they could just go to some communities and train young people or old people on how to cast their votes, maybe like come 2023 or during the local government election. Or some are really intentionally, you know, driving political dialogues, trying to create an awareness. Because, for instance, I do not even know my rights as a Nigerian, even if I'm educated. For the first time, you know, during the protest, we never knew that it only takes 50,000 signatures to recall your senator, you know, representing your constituency. And, you know, these are rights that were our fundamental rights that were there, but because we were not aware, we just didn't care. But now we want to care, because we know that if we want to make this change to happen, it's time for us to be at the forefront. You know, I don't want to get too political, but I know that when we have an aligned government, development and innovation will catch up with us. You know, so we don't want a situation where whatever idea we're bringing is being counteracted somewhere, either from the local government or some kind of unfavorable policies and all. We are educating ourselves because we don't want, you know, to still keep falling deep into this challenge, you know, into this wrong narrative that, oh, Africa is a corrupt nation. Yes, it is, because of, you know, what we see, but we don't want that to happen. And in order to ensure that we don't want that to continue, we are like taking up responsibility, you know, championing certain kind of changes in local communities, whether it's through political orientation, gender equality, women knowing their rights, you know, in the society, etc. So I'm happy you talked about this, you know, but, you know, I could go on and on. But the whole thing is that there's an awakening. People are becoming really conscious and people are, you know, taking up the reins of responsibility.
And that is such a powerful and beautiful note to finish this conversation on. Very hopeful, lots of hope for next year and the future. And obviously all the best of luck with building this Africa by us for us. I think it's an amazing, amazing incentive. And it definitely seems certain that there is a huge, not only need, but real hunger for this movement. So if, again, echoing what I said at the beginning of the show, if this is what you can achieve in 3 years, I think there is just so much to come. And when we will be catching up next year and the year after, I think there will be a lot of success stories to share. So thank you again, Amanda, for joining me for this conversation. Lots of takeaways, very bold and rich conversation. And I'm sure there's plenty for the listener to take away also.
And thank you so much, Baba, for such a wonderful session. Trust me, I'm happy because it was a way of pouring out my heart and my concerns about, you know, the work we do and, you know, the need, how we would like our country, you know, to be more favorable for us.
Wow, what a rich conversation that was. I would like to thank Amanda again for being so honest and transparent in her views and experiences. And I hope this has given you some content to reflect on and has given you a different perspective of Africa. I love doing this episode and I'm pleased that I have the privilege to amplify the voices of such change agents as Amanda. Please rate and review this podcast, share it with your friends and colleagues, and let me know what you thought. My details are in the description section, or tweet using hashtag Change Agent Podcast. I am Vibe Ziga, and wherever you are, stay safe, and until next time.